Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is the one, the only co-host with the most, the Romulan without the ale, Mr. Spencer Williams.
Hey, thanks, man.
We also got with us today the intern slash part-timer slash sonographer slash coffee bringer who brings no coffee slash on the cusp of a possible promotion.
What? Amy?
We got the word up from HR, and there might be room for that in the budget.
As long as I'm not a red shirt,
in
10
years.
Not expendable. Wait, what?
We got a great show in store as we are kicking off this month's celebration of the sci-fi just staple classic series and franchise, and that is Star Trek. So stick around as we dive into the first night of that. But before we do, Spencer, give us some opening credits.
Tune in each and every Thursday.
Thursday. She almost missed it. Yeah, I listened to last week's episode, and I'm like, oh my God, we were all over the place.
Tune in Thursdays from now on your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We have a website. It is filmlosophers.com. And there we have a lot of things. Those things are episodes that you can check out. We allegedly have over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, even sci-fi, because we did this last year, and this is our second time around. So we are excited to do that. But if you want to check out last year's or any other episodes, head on over to our website at filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune in to your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or a subscribe, and let us know how we're doing. If you like the episode or if you don't, let us know in the comments. And if you think we're worth it, give us a 5-star review, because we've earned it.
We have.
Indeed.
Indeed, she says.
Indeed.
Indeed. Make it so.
I'm starting to think we got an android over here. We are excited to kick off Star Trek month with a slew of really great reviews that we're going to be talking about within the Star Trek universe. But before we do, we wanted to talk about a little piece of information of some interesting movie news. And with that, we have the release of the fabled, the famed, the ever so anticipated final film of Hayao Miyazaki's work with Studio Ghibli.
Final again, yeah.
apparently, this is the final
this
part
is,
two.
Yeah. From him, he's like, this is my final.
Like, so, I'm going to be honest. I'm not going to believe it till like...
I hate to say it. I kind of agree, like, because he might be on his deathbed in the middle of making another movie.
I honestly feel like that's how he's going to go out.
So here's the thing, because we haven't even talked about what the heck we're talking about in this
movie. I know, sorry.
But... I think one of the things we have to keep into consideration is the emphasis on the wording that he uses. Because when it comes to things like this, especially with Hollywood or the industry as a whole, I feel like you have to take everything at wrestling type storytelling. Because wrestlers will do like career matches. And the only reason why they do career matches is so they can take a break off for like 6 months and then come back afterwards. It's like, oh my God, he's supposed to be retired, but he's back. Oh my God. You know, they do those types of things, like those career ending matches. I use air quotes as I'm saying it, career ending matches. Mm-hmm. So this could be his like career ending film that he does, like as it's finalizing. And then it was like, oh no, you didn't read the fine print. It was just my last film with this one particular guy at Studio Ghibli. And then the next one is, well, it's my last film at Studio Ghibli. And then it's like, oh, it's my last film not with Studio Ghibli. Oh, like, I'm pretty sure it'll keep going. I mean, who knows? He seems pretty content with this time around, but then he's also said it before. So back to what we were talking about, which was the trailer finally dropped, or I think it's a teaser trailer. It's not a full trailer. The teaser trailer dropped for Miyazaki's last supposedly film. Excuse me. titled The Boy and the Heron. This movie, which they did drop a little bit of the synopsis as well, surrounds the story of a young boy named Mahito, yearning for his mother, ventures into a world shared by the living and the dead. There, death comes to an end and life finds a new beginning. It's also noted as saying it's a semi-autobiographical fantasy about life, death, and creation in tribute to friendship from the mind of Hayao Miyazaki. So we got a chance, all three of us here, to see the trailer. And interestingly enough, I did mention to the team yesterday when we were all together, we were talking about the trailer and that we should talk about this on the show. And I said, watch, it's going to be, because Spencer has a very large aversion to Grave of the Fireflies.
For good reason.
I mean, I don't know why.
What? It is depressing with a capital D.
Can confirm.
So I actually made the little funny jab that, look, yesterday, his movie is, yesterday, ugh, that it's probably going to be Grave of the Fireflies part two, Electric Boogaloo.
Because I've been saying everything Electric Boogaloo first.
And it's really been graining. But oddly enough, we saw the trailer, and your first impression, Spencer, as soon as you started watching it.
The second it started, I was like, oh, it's Grave of the Fireflies. I hate it.
I win.
I don't care. I don't like it. Just no.
I just don't really know enough about what exactly is going to, because it looks like it's going to be kind of psychedelic, like Spirited Away, but it's also going to have some elements of like Totoro and Grave of the Fireflies. But it's, I mean, it looks like it's going to touch on so many different elements that I'm just at a loss to even kind of comprehend where he's heading with this one.
I mean, I kind of just don't want to.
Why not?
So, Amy, what were your thoughts on with the trailer?
Well, I first off was like, as soon as it opened and I saw that it mirrored fairly similar Grave of the Fireflies, which we have to remember, he wasn't the person that directed Grave of the Fireflies.
Yeah, I remember.
but it smacked very soundly from that initial shot. And
this
I was like,
trailer
no.
smacked, according to Amy.
Slaps. Well, it did have a lot of some of those initial, like, in watching Spirited Away, some of that, but I wouldn't call it psychedelic, because psychedelic is more this is kind of trippy, but not psychedelic.
Literally just the same word in different roundabout ways. Semantics, essentially. Either way, but like, no, I feel like some of the fantastical and whimsy ways that Miyazaki, you know, led his creative team to do the animation for, like, Spirited Away is one key one that's always like that. Mm-hmm. Totoro has its moments. Especially with like the cat bus and all that kind of stuff. I feel like there's going to be a little bit of that kind of whimsy if we're trying to put a more finesse touch on the word instead of saying trippy or psychedelic like 60s hippies. A little bit of a fantastical whimsy to it. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's also dealing with death, and death is going to be kind of a mainstay of the storyline, it also kind of leads more in my mind to the mindset of like Spirited Away, which they're all, you know, gods, and they're all kind of on the other side of.
Well, they also originally, when Miyazaki announced that he was going to be making one more final film, he had mentioned that his goal was to explore death, life after, and your legacy. So this was kind of in me knowing that and seeing seeing it once and very briefly, mind you, I was like, oh, okay. And I'm intrigued, but some of it I'm just going to like, how far is he going to go? Because there was one shot of the lady that was laying on the couch and she did like the ripply, like you guys have
she
to
did
see
the
it.
Poltergeist thing where her skin just melted away.
And I was just like,
that's very poltergeist-esque. Because there's a scene in there where one of the people goes into the bathroom and he starts like feeling his face just fall apart.
Oh, that's not comforting at all.
I'm not the biggest fan of Grave of the Fireflies, but I also see it for what it is. Yes, it's depressing, but it's also a point of art, as we have been so aptly pointing out within the genre of animation, and making sure we remind others to see it as well. It's a point of art, and it has its own story to tell. even if it's one of those stories that you can only watch once, you have to appreciate it. You don't have to like it, looking at you, Spencer, but you do have to appreciate the work that went into it.
I do appreciate the work that went into it. Hey, don't you? I sat through that movie. I got it to the end, okay?
How many times did it take you to do that?
Once.
You sat through it one time.
Because the thing was, I was like, oh, I should stop. But then I was like, then I would have to come back.
Yeah.
And that's just not going to happen. So
it hurts. Let's
go. It's like a doctor's visit. Just go on getting it over with one time.
Yep.
In terms of some of Miyazaki's tropes, because he's got plenty of tropes that he has when it comes to his movies, whether if it's whimsical characters or focal points or having to deal with, you know, gods or spirits in most of his films, or having to do with kind of some type of mirroring of his own life as well. Which one do you think, because there's always one of those that kind of strongly takes anchor within the story, which one of his tropes do you think is going to be kind of the staple for this film?
Ooh. I'm getting like... I feel like, I don't know. It's like, I just get like a little bit of everything from the trailer. So like, unless like we get another trailer that's like more concrete, I feel like we might just be like getting a touch of just about little everything he's done. And like,
kind of like a sampler platter of everything that he's done combined in.
Yeah. With like maybe an overarching thing tied those all together.
I think that's a good projection or prediction. I almost want to say like the spiritual whimsy side kind of pulls out just slightly ahead for the fact that it's in a realm where death and life kind of exist, coexist on the same plane of existence.
Mm-hmm. But the only thing is like, because it was a teaser, we have no idea how much that actually factors.
Exactly, exactly. What about you, Ames, while you're furiously researching over there?
No, I've started... poorly researching, because apparently it was already released in Japan in July, which means there's a full mock-up of everything on a Wikipedia, and I'm not reading it. That's the problem.
You say you're not because, reading no, it, but you look
I
like
got,
I'm not reading it.
I got to the release date, and I was like, "I'm sorry, what?" And then it says Japan, and I'm like, "No."
So, did the movie release, or did
the movie was already released? It came out in July in Japan. But people were noting that they intentionally did not do any like trailer releases or any international like announcement of it. And I'm like, oh, well, that's interesting. I don't know how I feel. But in regards to tropes, I think because he has always been with everybody that he's written, the journey aspect of it. And, you know, you can't go through something and not be changed. And this is the question that I probably have, is that everybody we've seen in regards to his heroes and heroines in his movies have always retained life. There's, even though, like, in Totoro, there's the question of are they alive or are they dead at the end of the movie. Everybody else seems to come back to the real world, and I'm wondering... what's gonna happen with this kid?
Yeah, I mean, this could be like a nice twist on Spirited Away, where like, you know, instead of going back,
he stayed dead.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
And yeah. I'm hoping for really delicious food. That trope never gets old. I don't care how many times this man makes movies. If there's something to eat in there, I'm gonna want to eat it.
Well, we will continue to watch for this film, and apparently, if it's out, maybe even see if we can find a way to watch it as well with the subtitles on. And yeah, well, obviously we're all Miyazaki fans here, and so we're excited to see what he's got coming to the States. But that does transition us over to our kickoff episode review of the month. And as we are talking about Star Trek and Star Trek Month, of course, our resident Borg member, Mr. Spencer
Borg. He's not part of the collective.
Yeah, you haven't said anything. Look at your phone. There's our local Borg member,
could
Mr.
Could you be part of the Q continuum?
Spencer, take it away on our review.
Welcome, everybody. I'm in charge of this ship now, so you sit back over there. All right. So I'm going to start our review of Star Trek Nemesis with a little synopsis. The Enterprise is diverted to the Romulan homeworld of Romulus, supposedly because they want to negotiate a peace treaty. Captain McCard and his crew discover a serious threat to the Federation once Praetor Shinzon plans to attack Earth. The movie is directed by Stuart Baird. This film stars Patrick Stewart with Jonathan Frakes, Brent Spiner, LeVar Burton, Michael Dorn, Marina Sirtis, Gates McFadden, Ron Perlman, and Tom Hardy. In an interview given after the film came out, Tom Hardy said that he took the role very seriously, as it was intended to be his big break. The commercial failure of the film and the response from longtime fans apparently led to his relationship dissolving.
His relationship dissolving,
his turn to alcohol, and considering suicide. It was only when he pulled himself together and starred in Bronson in 2008 he got over this film.
Is a magnificent movie. Bronson is, I don't know if you guys have ever even seen.
Nope,
so Bronson is the true telling, well, so to speak, exaggerated biographical telling of this prison inmate in the UK. I believe it's UK, who went by another name, but while he was in prison, this takes place during the 70s and 80s, saw a Charles Bronson movie and decided he was going to rename himself to Bronson, for the fact that he's like the most BA guy in all of like TV history at the time, or film history. So it's very interesting. It's very eclectic. It's not necessarily like a brawler type, you know, oh, I'm a tough guy, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's several scenes of him like full nudity. So you can't be tough and show your wang at the same time.
According to Star Trek lore, yes, you can.
Go ahead, Spencer. Anyway.
This was Jerry Goldsmith's final score for a theatrical movie. He died on July 21st, 2004 from stomach cancer. Mm-hmm. Since Goldsmith scored both the first Star Trek motion picture in 1979, Star Trek movie, and this one, his music effectively bookends the original 10 series of movies before it was rebooted in 2009 with Star Trek.
Wow.
More than a third of this film, including most of the character moments and a great chunk of expository dialogue, was deleted before the final release, and it seems like it was at least 50 minutes of it was just taken out of the movie.
Yeah. which it's interesting because like we talked about it because we saw the film together, and there's a lot of interesting stuff that was cut out, and
there's a lot of interesting words from this director.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to get into that.
We will.
But before we really get into this movie, I want to talk about your experience with the last Star Trek we did last year. Like, what were your takeaways from that, and what were your expectations going into this month that we're about to do? Amy, let's go with you. You look like you're excited.
I'm actually excited. So prior to, and this is not Star Trek II, the Electric Boogaloo, Star Trek Month.
Although she's been saying that nonstop for like God knows how long.
Like the last couple
it's
of
like,
weeks.
You haven't even seen that movie and you keep saying that. Like,
it's just
everyone says it.
Yeah, and it bugs me to all heck because it's like, okay, then watch the movie so you know what you're talking about. It's like the people who used to do the whole Warriors come out. Like people would do that and make fun of it. How long ago did you watch that?
Oh, quite a while.
I'm sorry, what? It was probably like, what, 6, 7 years ago?
No, it was probably like 10 to 12 years ago.
I don't believe you.
6 and 7 is quite a while ago.
You know what, Spencer? You want to keep dating yourself? Go ahead. I feel like we're gonna have to put that on the list for either upcoming. We're gonna have to watch Breaking 1 and then Breaking 2, which is where
I have a feeling we're gonna have a lot of time coming up in the upcoming months of not really many movies coming out.
That is true. Yeah. That would be an interesting Christmas season to do that. Like, happy holidays, and this is Breaking 1.
So I had a really fun time actually delving into Star Trek last year when we had Star Trek Month, because prior to that, I had not seen any of the original or the Prime Universe films. I had watched TNG because that was part of what we did, I guess, like during that era. And I was vaguely aware of other things and how Star Trek kind of had interplayed and helped create and shape lots of aspects of pop culture. But I really enjoyed it. And the whales. I think the whales and looking for the nuclear vessels was great. But expectations for this, for this month, I didn't really know what was coming. I vaguely kind of knew and had seen the 09 Star Trek. So we'll talk about that next week. But this one, I didn't know Tom Hardy was in this. So, like, I'm excited. I like learning. And Spencer's a good guide. And he answers my questions when I bring him up during the movie.
I just have to say, watching a movie with Amy is like watching a movie with some of the people that
Not in a movie theater, though. That's a different story.
Even at home, it's like, you know what? It's fine. Because for me, it's like decorum goes all over the place. It's like universal knowledge. If I'm sitting in front of you, Spencer, and I decide to start eating something, I'm not going to eat and do that in front of you. I would have the decorum to make sure that I wouldn't. But this woman over here has this innate just tick about herself to ask questions in the middle of movies that nobody, well, the majority of the party hasn't seen. And so stopping full momentum so she can ask questions that have no bearing on the film whatsoever is just ridiculous at the time.
It's not ridiculous. Come on. No, it wasn't seriously. Ridiculous because, so, dear listeners, we had planned to watch Star Trek Nemesis.
She's interrupting the momentum of this.
Yes, but mind you, because of schedules, it had gone all wonky and we were doing it the day prior to this recording. I had seen the first 10 minutes of it. I had questions. Eddie, you had seen the first 40 minutes of it?
And we hadn't seen any of the, we hadn't seen the whole movie at all.
No, we got to the first 9 minutes and I was like, I have a
question. I was super busy prior to, and I only got up to like maybe almost
Spencer
an hour.
Spencer humors me. This is why he likes me.
Like a child. So anyway.
Unmitigated rudeness.
No,
he's a red shirt.
I like how she knows these little bits of like pop culture and throws them in there just to show that she knows things.
And no
red
more.
Shirts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scalzi's really good. Hey.
Anyway.
Spencer got my joke.
Anyway.
Yes.
Eddie, what about you?
Oh my gosh. Honestly, last year was really fun. It was interesting because I as well watched TNG sporadically throughout my childhood because my dad's the bigger Trekkie fan. He likes Star Trek. He watched the original series as well as the Picard series. After that, I kind of just fell off the map with Star Trek. I didn't watch any of the other things until like my later years. But I do remember going to the theaters to seeing most of the Next Generation movies.
Oh, okay,
so
cool.
like I saw First Contact. I saw Nemesis in theaters. I saw, what was the one before First Contact? Generations?
Yes, Generations.
I saw Generations in theaters. Like I saw all those in the movie theaters with my dad. So I do remember that. I also am quite aware of the multitude of pop culture references that you can literally watch probably one season of Futurama and have a precursory knowledge of what to say in little quips here and there, Amy. So in terms of like a lot of that, I do know that much. But outside of what I learned last year, honestly, everything that we went through last year was really, you know, eye-opening. I didn't know how vast, how deep, or even how much heart there was to the original stories from, like, with Captain Kirk and all that pertaining to his team and whatnot. Even the death scene of Spock in the second one, I honestly had seen, obviously, like I said, pop culture references, and I may have seen it in meme form or maybe like a clip here or there. But seeing the full breadth of that entire film and what leads to that and watching that scene fully, you know, give me everything that it was meaning to show me for that to be so meaningful to Star Trek fans. Like, because you look at it and you're like, oh, this is just one of those memes. Like, yeah, he was the most human. Like, everyone's like, oh, yeah, that's that funny thing. This is that. And I'm like, I'm watching it and I'm like, oh, my God. Like, I can see why, you know, the way that scene plays, why it's such a crucial, like, moment for a lot of Star Trek fans and so forth. So it really gave me a lot more knowledge that I can hold on to as a rookie, I guess, you know, Star Trek fan. Although I still don't keep up with this current TV series or streaming series and all that.
Yeah, but especially right now, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's like a multitude of series that are going on, and then one just ended, and then whatever else now is going on. So in terms of expectations, like my expectations for this month is to kind of delve into more of what the smaller nuances that occur in these movies, because I'm realizing that it's not so much the big stories, but it's the micro moments, like the individual scenes that really give more of the connecting tissues for fans to the overarching storyline. Like, and again, I haven't seen it, but what is that one? The prequel series?
Prequel series?
The prequel streaming series.
Strange New Worlds.
Yeah, Strange New Worlds.
Fantastic, by the way.
Yeah, I keep hearing that. And I keep hearing about these amazing scenes that create these connective moments to the original series, you know, that give it the credence to why that was so meaningful, because this and this and this. It's like, it's kind of like, interestingly enough, what the Star Wars universe is doing in terms of giving more credence with great storytelling and great storytellers to build out the small parts in between to create a much fuller storyline. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, you got to admire like the work and the time that people are putting into that, because you go all the way back and you look at storyline after storyline from like the original series that, you know, where they had, as Spencer mentioned last year, where they had the really horrible, you know, uniforms and whatnot. And,
The Monster Maroons.
Oh my gosh.
And you take a look at some of the storylines that are pieced throughout that one and how they're integrated with the storylines that they're putting in with Strange New Worlds and all these other storylines. And it's like, oh, that's cool. And, you know, it makes you hungry to want to know more.
Yeah. Like the brief thing I'll say about Strange New Worlds, because I don't want to get sidetracked with it, is that one of the best things that they do is like, there's like something from the original series that like, it's just like a light thing they touched on. Like, oh, Spock has a mate or whatever. And like, you're like, oh, how come we don't really know anything? And then Strange New Worlds comes around and it's like, well, let's get to know this person.
Yeah.
And like, you find out, oh, this person's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just builds on like the fandom and the love that people have for that original series, and why it's creating the not that it should or that it has to, but it is creating the importance as to why you should go back to the beginning and rewatch some of those episodes and really kind of embrace some of the hokiness. Of course, it's the 70s and whatnot. You know, you got a lot of little bit of like
the first one's the 60s.
Okay, well, 60s and 70s and stuff like that. Like even through to the 80s, I'm assuming.
Well, with the movies,
yeah. Like you get a lot of the hokiness, the campiness of it, but there's still some truth in there that can be reined in and created to ultimately breed a beautiful storyline, like the one that you just mentioned. So.
All right. For me, I'm the Star Trek veteran here, so I'm just expecting to have fun times while my friends find out things that irk me and then find things that they also like, possibly.
Yay! It sounds like a plan.
All right, so moving straight into it, let's talk about expectations for this one. Well, I mean, we already did that, basically. Let's talk about first impressions after viewing the movie.
Well, just kind of taking a step back, it had been years since, like, literally the first and only time I saw this movie, like I said, was in theaters. I hadn't seen it since.
Right.
So, honestly, the fact that I had no recollection of who Tom Hardy was at the time, obviously, because it was his breakout role, knowing who Tom Hardy is now and how much of a impactful actor he is, my actual expectation for this film was I was going to see somebody who is great now play against somebody who is still great now, but was also great then too, with, you know, Patrick Stewart, you know, and creating that, you know, juxtaposition between their two characters. And as we talk about it, why it was so unique because of the fact of the relation to each other. So that was honestly my biggest expectation. I was going to go back to a time where Tom Hardy was not, you know, what's his name from Lawless, or he wasn't this person from X movie, or he's not Bane. You know, I was born of this. You know, all that kind of stuff. No, that was nowhere on the scope yet. So, and then obviously before Bronson too as well. So that was my expectation.
Nice, Amy.
My expectation was, this is Tom Hardy. What? I really didn't know what to expect because I had actually kind of enjoyed what happened with Generations. First Contact, actually, despite some of the cringe factor in weird places, it was a good movie. But this, I really did not know what to expect. I was excited to see Jean-Luc. And there was things that I forgot from watching First Contact. We're like, oh yeah, things happened. I forgot about that. Okay. But yeah, so my expectations were not very many because I hadn't seen this at all.
Okay. Okay. Well, there you go.
So it's just like, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. For me, I wanted to basically come in this movie and be like, is this movie as bad as the fandom says it is? Mm. Because this movie is divisive. Yes.
Well, here's a quick question then for you.
Mm, yeah.
How many times have you actually seen this film?
Are we talking about the multiple times recently I just watched it?
Sure.
Okay, then that brings the grand total up to 3. I watched it once with you and then once by myself. And then once initially.
I'm like, we're missing one.
Oh, yeah, sorry. because like I watched it the one time and I was like, ugh. I was not happy, mm-hmm. to say the least. So this is one of those things where, like, you know, like when your kids just like see a movie, it's like, oh, this movie is really great. And you come back to it and you're like, oh, this movie is garbage. And so I kind of wanted to know like how I would feel about this as an adult. So that's how I kind of was coming into this movie. And then, Eddie, did you give me your impression of this? Or did you just give me an expectation?
I just gave the expectation.
We both gave expectations. Okay. Yeah. All right.
So let's go with impressions after seeing the movie.
So my first impression right outside the gate after seeing the movie was, okay, this is obviously a young Tom Hardy. That's mm-hmm. fine. I didn't expect to see so much unrefinedness in his role, but I could also see some of the things that he built upon to be the actor that he is today, and which is greatly appreciated by his work, you know. But and then also seeing kind of where the Star Trek crew was at that point in time, it was also interesting. It was very interesting. I don't know if I would say it was like a great movie. Mm-hmm. It definitely was on the scale of, okay, I can get something out of this. But in terms of its like overall, like, oh, this movie just, oh my God, my heart, you know, I don't think I was walking away with tears and, you know, angry letters to the Academy for why no Oscars kind of thing.
Mm. Amy.
I can actually... very much akin to Eddie. There wasn't any moment in this film where I felt like the way I did about seeing Spock initially die, or the send off, or shoot, even the ridiculousness of the whales, of saving the whales.
There'll be whales here.
This movie for, again, Tom Hardy, which was unexpected, and he went all in. Like, I can never fault him for committing 100%. There's some things that I was just like, okay, this movie? And then you're like, there's 20 minutes of deleted scenes. And I'm like...
That we had access to. We had apparently more.
Oh, gosh. But we did the 20 minutes of the deleted scenes. And I was just like, there were things that were cut out that should not have been cut out. Mm-hmm. There were things that had been left in that should not have been left in. There were things that were cut out that should have stayed cut out and should have not been teased as they should have been left in. Yeah. So I had mixed feelings about this, and not in the delightful aspect of like, I'm like this and I don't like this. No.
What about you, Spencer? Because we're kind of spiraling over there.
Okay. So for me, I'm going to say something rather controversial.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
I don't think this is the worst of the...
The camping one?
Of like the 10
main
movies.
10?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because now like rewatching it and like just getting like... I kind of feel like the one before this, actually, Star Trek Insurrection, which we skipped over and I just realized I didn't give a description of, is worse. Mostly because it's boring. But like it is just, like, to me, was beyond boring. But
But now, wait, I want to know what Insurrection is.
Insurrection is... So there are a group of people called the Baku, and they are on this planet which for some reason slows their aging down. And I know, nerds, I haven't seen the movie in a while, so it's going to be a very generic overview.
I'm okay with generic.
The Federation, there's another group of people. I forget what their name is. The Sona, yes.
Even Janeway mentions the Sona in this movie.
And
it was a reference to the last movie.
Okay.
Do you want me to read you the plot that someone has here?
Sure.
You have an official synopsis?
Well, this is somebody's synopsis. While on a mission to observe the peaceful Baku race, Lieutenant Commander Data suddenly behaves as if having to fear for his existence. The immortal Baku, whose planet offers regenerative radiation and therefore incredible lifespans, live in harmony with nature and reject advanced technology. Their planet and their culture is secretly researched by the Federation associated with an alien race called the Sona. But the Sona intend to abduct the Baku in order to take the planet for themselves and for the Starfleet officials who all would like to regenerate their bodies. But they do not think of the loyalty of Captain Jean-Luc Picard and the crew of the USS Enterprise NCC-1701-E to the Prime Directive.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one. Yeah, the thing that makes it boring is that for a good chunk of the movie, I know this is weird to say, there's a lot of like talking, but it feels like it's about almost nothing. Mm. Also, Picard has a love interest with one of the Baku, and it's not Beverly, and so I'm upset about that, their whole thing.
It's always supposed to be Beverly.
By the way, it was also directed by Jonathan Frakes.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, but this was more of a story problem than anything, but like...
So it was better shots than Nemesis?
To my recollection, yes.
Okay.
But yeah, I kind of feel like that's kind of the worst one. But moving on to this movie, yeah, so let's just talk about the actors. Let's start highlighting people. We've already mentioned Tom Hardy a lot.
So we have to bring up Tom Hardy not only because he's... He almost said Shinron, and that's not his name.
That's the dragon from Dawson.
I know. That's why I was like, wait.
Shenzhen.
Shenzhen, Shenzhen, Shinninini, Shamalamaboo-boo,
no,
whatever you want to call him.
No, none of those things.
They gave him a weird name, like a really weird name. It wasn't even like fanciful space name. Like
Shinzon? I mean, that's...
Your Shinzon?
That's what it says, Shinzon.
I don't like it. Anyway. Tom Hardy.
She's arguing with a movie that's over 20 years old. Go
yes,
ahead, keep talking.
I'm over 20 years old as well. So Tom Hardy committed so hard to this. And
even though you said, we've talked already about Tom Hardy, but was there anybody else? Tom Hardy just worked so hard.
You said we talked about? I said he committed. And in juxtaposition to the effervescent, please don't ever die, we'll put your head in a jar and hopefully we can do that, you know, Futurama thing that is,
as I stated
Sir
earlier.
Patrick Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
How they interplayed was just, it was wonderful. Like, it was balanced and I like them in that regard. Eddie, stop doing the eye-rolling
like,
thing.
You literally were like, we already talked about Tom Hardy. She goes, Tom Hardy was just, you know, oh my gosh. And Tom, yeah.
All right. So I'm going to talk about Tom Hardy too. because I just want to say this. I feel like it is asking a lot for a brand new, like, actor to be like, hey, we need you to act across Patrick Stewart, like this juggernaut. Like, that alone just is a lot to ask from like anyone, especially someone who doesn't have the experience prior to this, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
So I feel that, you know, he did pretty well for what he knew at the time. So there's a lot of wonkiness with that character and like how he came into being and the whole situation of Romulus and the Remans and that weirdness, which I want to get into with the story later on. But I think on the positives, I will also point out Brent Spiner as Data.
Yep.
Yay!
He always knows exactly where to hit the character as the emotionless robot. He is always the heart of like the TNG stories. Mm-hmm. He does such just a fantastic job of just portraying like an android that is trying to learn what it truly means to be human.
I mean, ultimately, Data is the audience's point of view on the ship itself, because even though he has access to information and the information is given at times where it's needed, obviously in briefings and whatnot, his you know, inquisitory nature is kind of on par with where we are when we're watching the movies. Like, well, wait, why does this happen? Well, why do you guys do this? Like, because according to the world of Star Trek, not everything is always the same, even with human, what does he call them? Human celebrations or humanistic behavior, like they were talking about with the weddings and with funerals and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like when it comes to like human rituals and stuff like that.
But that was part of the deleted scenes.
No, but he's also made questions about that before. And it's always been in an effort to help us understand what their perspective is on those things,
mm-hmm.
you know, to better understand what they see as valuable, as opposed to what we as humans in the real world, how we perceive certain things and whatnot. So I really do think Brent Spiner does a fantastic job of creating this aloof yet still child, almost like childlike, you know, inquisitive nature about him to keep us in the loop. For like, okay, so this might not make sense to everyone else, so I'm going to ask it as per the script. I'm going to ask it and give the explanation so that everybody else can learn. It's like, I know the answer, but he doesn't, so can you explain it to him out loud so we all can hear kind of thing? So,
like you do.
So, other than Brent Spiner, you know, I think we also got to highlight, you know, it's always great seeing LeVar Burton on screen as Geordi LaForge. LeVar Burton is just an icon, period. Mm-hmm. Like you look
Sacramento
at
Sacramento treasure.
You look at everything that he's done and especially his work on Star Trek, it never seems to age and it's always timeless, no matter what he's doing or however he looks with or without the, you know, the visor. And it was really good seeing him in full, you know, capacity in this one. I don't know what exactly his role was in the one before this one, because it looked like he was in that one as well. I just don't know if it was like as big of a role, because he's pretty, you know, present in most of the scenes in this film.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he's a part of some of the more pivotal scenes as well in terms of decision making and choices for certain character arcs and whatnot. So,
right. Nice.
Ames?
I was trying to look up Deanna Troi's actor. She's
Marina Sirtis.
Yes.
I have always loved.
You could also look at the notes, because the notes has it too.
Thanks.
I'm just saying.
I have always loved Counselor Troi.
Mm-hmm.
And this, in weird spaces, I don't feel did justice to the breadth of character that she has been across the TNG universe. Mm. And even in the other movies where she actually did pop up. So I was not disappointed in her acting. I was disappointed in how they pigeonholed her. And then...
What do you mean pigeonholed?
She's... So, like, we barely see Beverly, right?
Mm-hmm.
We see her, like, fleeting.
So, are you talking about Beverly or are you talking about Deanna?
No, I'm talking about Deanna. We barely see Beverly. And when we see Deanna, there are issues with the story that I have that just leave her out for dumb stuff.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like her she's, more than that. I feel like she was as crucial to the story as much as anyone else in there. Like, I feel like if it wasn't for her, they probably all would have died at the end of the film. You know, so I don't think she was minimally used, maybe poorly handled, but minimally used she was not. She was definitely a part of the majority of the film.
I will say that for most of the run of TNG, they had a hard time using Counselor Troi properly.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, even though she's supposed to be an empath and, mm-hmm. like, have an, like access to emotions of other people... Constantly, they are putting her on the bridge. And then Picard turns to her as like counselor, and she's like, "I cannot feel anything." And it's just like constantly, just like putting like her like there, but not giving her something to do. This movie, like it, I feel like it's like leans a little bit into that, like, you know, part where she isn't always given something to do, but it does give her something ultimately, which is. Yeah. It's better than what she normally gets, which I do appreciate.
Yeah, I feel like there's a much more substantial purpose for her in this film. Like I said, I don't recall Insurrection, so I don't know what her role was in that. But I know that if she, for a franchise such as Star Trek, women play a substantial role, not only in their ability to have leading roles in that franchise when men were the kind of overarching kind of roles given, but also the fact that in this film, it seemed like, in my opinion, if I hadn't seen any, like, a good majority of this, of the new Next Generation series, I probably would be like, oh, she's pretty awesome. Like, she has a great, you know, ability and a pretty good role. I wonder what else she's done in the series. And then you go to stuff like that, like, oh, crud. Never mind.
I mean, they do give her occasionally, like some good character developments in the series. Like, there was this one episode where, like, there was a disaster on the ship, and she was the only, like, senior officer on the bridge, and they were like, hey, what do we do? And she was struggling. And, like, but, like, it was actually good that she was struggling, because you realize, I actually need to be trained for, like, command more. And, yeah, like, she, it started an arc of her, like, learning to, like, be part of a command program. It was really great, actually.
Yeah.
Let's see. Who else is good to talk about in this movie?
Amy kind of broke the surprise already before the episode about the Viceroy being played by Ron Perlman.
I thought you knew.
I didn't know. I was like, when he starts talking,
I'm like, Ron Perlman? And then on seeing when you put into the notes Ron Perlman, I was like, oh, I was right. And I was like, well, you hid that very well, because I don't think anybody's bringing up this movie in his.
Actually, really briefly, want to talk about the makeup of, like, the aliens. Really well done.
He looked like a Predator. I'm not going to lie. Like, both in the film Predator franchise,
mm-hmm,
and a Predator in real life, kind of like creepy kind of Predator. So just wanted to say that.
Yeah, but the fact that, like, they didn't just give him, like, nose stuff mask or, like, ear stuff, like, it's a whole, like, face mask.
It's a whole,
like,
prosthetic, man.
Yeah, like, you can't, like, initially just look at him and be like, oh, that's Ron Perlman. Like,
yeah, that's where I was kind of running into, like, it sounds like him. I was like, no, but it can't be. It doesn't look like him. Like, they hit his chin and his jawline and everything, mm-hmm, with those prosthetics, and I was like, okay. And he was super creepy.
Yeah, he did a very good job as, like, a villain. I was, like, being ultra creepy and very, like, breaking people's boundaries. And then also being, like, kind of, like, you know, the silent, like, you know, general of Shenzhen's army.
Agreed.
Yeah. Is there anybody else you wanted to talk about, Ames?
What about you? Why is it me?
Because I've already said a few.
And I've said a few.
Yeah. Okay.
there's no one else we can.
I mean, I briefly.
See, this is why I throw it back to her, because I know there's always one more.
I tried to touch on Sir Patrick Stewart, but we already know that he is beautiful and incomparable, and there's nothing this man cannot do that we will not love him forever. Even if it was a terrible movie, we're like, but Sir Patrick Stewart, like.
I honestly think it would be the most shocking thing if he was the problem of a movie.
Right?
Like, I never know.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into the overall story of this movie.
The nitty gritty.
Yes, so starts off with a wedding scene, which, interestingly enough, features a lot of characters from the past that they don't even talk to in this movie.
Really?
Which is interesting, because you have Will Wheaton's Wesley Crusher show
he's
up.
He's just sitting there in the end. He's like, hi!
Yeah, which is interesting, because, like, this is his only appearance in the movies. Like, he's not in any of the previous ones.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so, like, since he left in TNG, this is, like, his first appearance. So it's crazy that, like, apparently there's a deleted scene with him talking, actually, and it's just cut.
Aww.
So, like, that's sad. So, like, there's, like, things like that about, like, I think that's one of the main problems of the movie, is that, like, it's missing a little bit of, like, character moments with, like, everyone.
Yeah, it seems like the wedding scene is one of those scenes where it's like, oh, we're all getting back together. Because you even see Whoopi Goldberg's role in this one.
Guinan.
Mm-hmm. Show up, and, you know, she has a brief moment of conversation with, you know, Geordi. And then it's gone. But it's like, okay. So there's like, a coming together of, like, the crew. Like, it's like a reunion kind of thing. But it's a wedding. So you'd expect that there would be a little bit more emphasis on the larger, like, roles that were important during the series to appear in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, like I said, I don't know.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know if you are aware that in the series, Counselor Troy has a mother whose name is Waxana Troy, who is also, her name is, what is it? Michelle Barrett, who was, like, literally the first lady of Star Trek, like, in the from TNG to Voyager, she is the voice of the computer.
Oh,
really?
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So, like she has like a long history with it, and like one of the things is that she couldn't be in this movie because she was working on the TV show Andromeda with Kevin Sorbo.
Quick question.
Sure.
And maybe this is just for clarification. So there's a joke that happens in the film that may kind of just go over a lot of people's heads. And I heard it and I didn't really kind of understand it. I know what it's insinuating, but I don't really know what the bearing on it is.
Mm-hmm.
So when Picard and Worf and Data are leaving to go explore the planet that they find the positronic signal on, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So Picard tells Riker that, you know, he obviously, you know, you have to stay here. Your wife would absolutely, you know, kill me if something happened to you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, Mr. Troy.
Mm-hmm.
He calls him by his wife's last name. Why does he call him by his wife's last name?
That's because of Waxana. Because she is such a, how do I put this? She's a lovely person, but she is a commanding presence when she's on. Picard is scared of her. Because anytime she's on the ship, she's just like, ugh. Troy's mother is always like very like, ooh, Captain Picard, what are you doing here? And like very touchy-feely. And of course, Jean-Luc is not any of that. He does not want to deal with it. So that's why he made that little jab.
Okay. Because I was like, is that something that, you know, one of them believes that, you know, you have to take the wife's last? It didn't make sense. But
no, that's specifically his new mother-in-law.
So what happens after we have the wedding?
So after the wedding, it's like you mentioned, they get a alert to a positronic signal, which is interesting because that seems like they should be able to just detect Data anywhere. So I don't understand how they're able to just detect that. So that seems like that should have thrown up a bit of a red flag to them.
Yeah.
I'll give them the fact that the Enterprise E is new and they had the Enterprise D before, so maybe there's that.
They're working their way through the alphabet. Got it.
So they arrive at a desert planet. Now, this planet is inhabited with people who are a pre-warp civilization, so that means that that's against the Starfleet Prime Directive for them to just outright talk to them. So they take a shuttle down and they're trying to find what is causing this positronic signal to go out. This is because positronic signals are basically, Data is a what's called a Soong type android, and these very specific androids are like the only ones that kind of put out this level of signal. So like the person, this is talked about more in the series, but the person who made them, like, he mostly just made two. It's Data and his brother, Lore. And the series,
which has been established in the series.
Yes, this has been established in the series, so you shouldn't know, like, about Lore, really.
Of the Omicron Percy I ate. Lure of the Omicron. Okay, never mind, go ahead.
I liked your Futurama joke.
They go around on this dune buggy that is never seen before or after.
But which makes sense for Picard because it's the Argo and we all know his, you know, familiarity with, you know, classic lore and...
And boats.
Yeah. So anyway, they find this broken apart android, which seems to be like an earlier model of Data. So they're like, okay, let's just put them together, see what's going on with this guy. While this is all happening, the Romulans send out a message to Starfleet and they're like, hey, we want to be in peace talks with you, which is the strangest thing that could possibly happen.
Heck yes.
The Romulans have been very anti. We don't want to talk to you people. Don't talk to us. We now have a neutral zone. You don't come in it. We don't mess with it. It's fine. So like it's a very tense relationship and it's been that way for a while. So the fact that they want to even talk now is just setting off alarm bells. That's why when Picard's like, set a course for Romulus, everyone's like, what?
I think we all were like, huh?
Yeah, so like the tension on the deck is like, that's why. It's a big deal. So we get to Romulus, and apparently there has been a big shakeup in the government, and a human is in charge who happens to be a clone of Jean-Luc Picard, played by Tom Hardy.
Yep.
With an extended nose. It wasn't bad, but it was extended.
Yeah, Yeah, let's stop here. This is crazy.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so like, to be fair, what's crazy about this is not the fact that the Romulans even wanted to do this. This is very on brand for them. They like having spies in places. Actually, the plan here with this clone was to basically replace Jean-Luc at some point and just have like their own spy on the inside of the Federation. This actually happens later with a Romulan posing as a Vulcan who ends up being chief of security of Starfleet.
Dang.
So
okay, so precedence is there. It can work.
This that happened after this. So like
they learned from their mistakes.
Yes, basically. But the thing that was weird about it for me is that in the second version of like that person who was a security officer, that was handled we're getting real deep into the lore now. That was handled by a section of the Romulans called the Tal Shiar, very specifically the Zat Vash. And
Zat Vash?
The Tal Shiar and the Zat Vash.
Yes. So like they are like secret organizations that run in like the Romulan like government.
So when I ask questions about like things later in the story that need to be resolved and you're like, oh, they have this, they would have access to that. Is this part of that like deep-seated lore?
Yeah, it is.
You really like the Romulans that much, huh?
Well, they're very interesting because, like, this isn't really talked about, like, in this movie because we're just focusing on them. But, like, they have, like, they are actually, like, part of, the Vulcans, actually. Mm-hmm. So the original series and future series have had this long ongoing thing of, like, the conflict between the Vulcans and the Romulans. And it's been very interesting. And then during TNG, like, Leonard Nimoy Spock shows up and he's like, enough is enough of this, we need to come together. And like he started like the seeds to like bring them back together. And so one of the long things for Star Trek is that like he is actually part of the force that finally brought the Romulans and the Vulcans back to one planet at one point in the future after Picard and all this stuff.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so it's kind of a big deal. The thing that troubled me about this whole Shenzon thing is that this definitely feels like a Tal Shiar type thing, but they are nowhere to be seen, which is very odd.
Regarding what? What exactly?
Basically, he's saying the nitpicky bits are there was somebody else that was pulling the strings, and they're like, no, it was just the regular Vulcans that did it. Surprise!
Vulcans?
Like, Romulans.
Romulans. Why did I say Vulcans?
Yeah.
They're so close together. That's a problem.
Because like this is like very specifically an information espionage type thing. And that screams this specific group of people who is well established at this point. So it just seems for me, them being missing from the story is weird. Like it's a minor nitpick, but I'm just trying to fill in your Star Trek knowledge.
I like that. I'm here for that. I'll just be like, Spencer, who was the espionage cuckoo nuts for the Romulans? You'd be like, these guys. So I was like, who was the super smart, like, back alley scientist for the Romulans? And you'll do that. Hey, don't oh your gosh this.
I'm waiting to hear more information from the man. You're over here trying to pull things out of anywhere. Can we let him finish? Let him finish.
I was letting him finish.
Go ahead, Spencer.
Okay, so this clone is part of the Remans, which is also a group that was, I think I had to look this up on like a thing. They basically started here. Like this is their first introduction for really.
I was going to ask you if this subset of Romulans was something mentioned prior to.
No, because like later on in the movie, like, because
they apparently have history.
That was the thing I was about to talk about, is like they were basically like, oh, we never talked about these people before. Let's fill in a backstory as if they were here the whole time.
So kind of just retconning certain events and,
or like just adding them in because there's enough space for them to just be added in, or you could be like, oh, okay, whatever.
Well, and the whole mention of, oh yeah, they were in these battles, they were warriors, and they were essentially cannon fodder. Nobody cares what happens to cannon fodder. They all get destroyed. So it makes sense.
Plus, like, the specific, like, Dominion War arc that they were referring to, a lot happened. So, like, them not being, like, fully front and center makes perfect sense. So we have them, and they're living on this side planet of Remus, and really, they don't matter. they're just here to be the big bads, because like I looked them up on the Memory Alpha, which is the Wikipedia for Star Trek, and they only show up in Star Trek Enterprise after this, which is set before this. So, like, when I say after, I mean, like, they showed up in the show in, like, 2004. But they are set previous to this movie. That's what happens when you have prequel series. Everything's all over.
Backfilling information. Got it.
All right, so from really here, we've got the rest of our movie playing out where Shenzon is basically trying to, he's trying to learn a little bit about like who Picard is, but also trying to be basically a space vampire and take all of Picard's blood because he needs it for himself. Because for some reason, he's the idea was to like put him in as a sleeper agent. He needed to skip over 30 years. They decided to not do that for some reason. And now he's dying because that was supposed to be a biological process that he went through. So he's got a very strong weapon warship that can just kill planets in an instant. So his plan is to go to the Federation, go to Earth, basically, kill everyone on Earth to really deal a deadly blow to the Federation and then just have like everyone else just take out the Federation as easily as possible for a Romulan victory on the Alpha Quadrant. That's really like the main story of the movie from that point on. So I kind of wanted to get like your guys' input. What did you think about just like the overall premise of the story compared to like maybe some of the previous ones we had?
Amy?
So clones are interesting. Mm-hmm. And in regards to utilizing them as a tool to have myself face myself, I don't know if it fully worked. Mm. I mean, we've already established prior that the Romulans are in and of themselves not just temperamental people, but they can get downright angry and nasty. And if creating a clone of Picard was the only way for them to have purchase against, you know, the Borg, or something to that effect, I don't know if it was used in the best way possible in this story. And also, there were other parts of this story that I did not approve of in any way, shape, or form. And it was not as delightful or fun or even as campy in some cases as the previous films had been.
I think we should probably dig into the problems you had with that movie. Actually, no, let's save that for the issue.
We have the issues. Yeah. That's the reason I diverted.
I would say the fact is that this plot has been done before in terms of having some form of yourself, some form of your past come back and be part of the opposing force. You know, we've seen it in things like Logan. We've seen it in things like The Prestige. We've seen it in things like, what was that other movie? In Us, where, yeah, you know.
That's a good one.
And you have this device, which is that's what it should be, a plot device. Mm-hmm. You know, even to a certain extent, one of the most classic sci-fi films of all time, Blade Runner, mm-hmm. where not necessarily are they exact replicas of Deckard, but the revelation that Deckard himself is also a Blade Runner or also a replicant and kind of coming to grips with his own personal mortality as one of them. There's a lot of these movies that do that, and a lot of them do it well because of the fact that they make the effort of being a clone not so much the primary directive, but the effort of creating memorable characters who we want to root to live for. Mm-hmm. You know, you take a look at like things like the twist in Us, mm-hmm. where you really have no intention of rooting for, you know, any of these people to be alive because they are these, you know, immensing, you know, opposing forces, but then you realize what they really are. And then you come to grips with the understanding of who the mom is and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh my gosh, yeah, this isn't fair. And this is, you know, you have a really big story that happens and you're rooting for the people to actually find a way. Case in point, like I said, with Blade Runner, you know, you come to absolutely admire, maybe not appreciate or even, you know, connect with, but you admire the efforts of Rutger Hauer's character in that one, as he is sincerely trying to just find a way to continue living on because he finds the things of this world wondrous. That whole ending monologue that he has, you know, I've seen things you would never have seen. I've seen the explosion of stars and star systems and blah, blah, blah. And you come to find yourself rooting for this. I don't think at any point in time, and this is not to the negativity of Tom Hardy's performance, but more so probably the writing and directing, mm-hmm. as Amy will go into about the director. Mm-hmm. but like, I feel like Tom Hardy just didn't seem like the type of character. He was climbing the stairs, but he never got to the top floor. Like all the makings were there for him to become that. And then there were these small little insertions of things about his character that was like, did you really have to?
Well, and also they made him in some places seem like he was just petty for petty's sake.
Which is weird because maybe a few scenes before that, there seems to be like a sincerity behind it. Yeah. There's like a sincerity behind, you know, being a clone and wanting to live and wanting to be able to learn more about, you know, how he has that dinner with Picard. And he's like, you know, oh, I want to know about our past. He goes, I want to know about your past, my future. And he goes, well, it's not the same. He goes, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot that is building towards making Tom Hardy a memorable villain that you want to see persist. And it doesn't quite make it there. And there's a really big scene in this movie that happens that really kind of shakes up your mentality of, well, then what is his real purpose? Like, what is he really behind? Like, is he somebody who wants to live? Is he somebody who wants to destroy? Is he somebody who just wants to get, you know, get laid? You know, it's one of those three things.
I think it also falls into the juxtaposition of in seeing Ricardo Montalban as as Khan in from last year when mm-hmm. we did that, and seeing what a powerful, well balanced villain he was, mm-hmm. where everything the story was elevated by him and his presence and his acting, and he didn't phone anything in, and Tom Hardy didn't phone anything in, but the story did not give him space to have that same impact, mm-hmm. where we root for Khan and we're like, okay, yeah, you're the bad guy, but I really like you. In this, we're like, I want to like Tom Hardy. I want to get in his corner, especially as Eddie was saying with that dinner with Picard where he's like, just tell me about us. Like, the balance of the sincerity that Tom Hardy portrays falls flat because the story takes him in a direction that deviates so desperately from, like, those, and I can't even say tropes, but it's like those yearning to be more, yearning to better understand, like, devices that other movies utilize when there's a clone, a replicant, wasn't the island one that had clones in it?
Yes. The island?
Yeah.
The island. You're talking about Michael Bay's. Yeah.
I couldn't remember. So
I mean, that kind of spoils it for everyone else. But so and it's true because here's the biggest issue that they didn't take into consideration. They put a brand new, just coming out actor to play up against somebody like Patrick Stewart, Sir Patrick Stewart. You need to have somebody as enigmatic, somebody who is as formidable as an actor as well as a presence to create that dichotomy of, oh my God, I love Picard. I really do. But, and it gives him that slight hesitation of like, I love Picard. I love who he is. I love his commanding. But this guy has something. And mm-hmm. and it goes back to, again, you know, the trifecta of, you know, unfortunately, the opposite of what makes a great film great. The opposite of that, what makes a bad film bad, you know, you poor writing, poor directing, and unseasoned actors, to put it plainly. You know, Tom Hardy now has the ability to step into a role and just disappear. But if you're looking at brand new Tom Hardy with subtle direction and whatnot, and the movements and whatnot that were given to him by his writing staff, it only makes sense.
Well, and I think that the writing did him no justice because there were glimmers through a good chunk where he was going toe-to-toe with Sir Patrick, where mm-hmm. he was standing in a space where you could see that Sir Patrick Stewart had come and said, hey, this is how, like, I've been playing Jean-Luc for quite a bit. This is how he would respond. Like, you can see some of that mentorship in their time together. But all the story continues to do is just be like, no, 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 no. No, you're the bad guy. And you got to be the bad guy.
Yeah.
And you're just like, what? But why?
Because the last act of this film just kind of nosedives into,
literally,
well, I'm the bad guy. Time to destroy everybody.
Uh-huh. I'm pissed off. You took my cookies.
Well, a lot of it seems to just stem from him being annoyed by the Romulans and being like, you're not doing the thing you said you'd do. And exactly. Just being prodded. It's like, all right, fine. I have to be the villain now. And like, I truly wonder if like a lot of the nuance of the character wasn't lost in editing. Because like we took a look at some of the deleted scenes and there's quite a few things where I'm like, I have no idea why you would cut even some of the really short ones.
Yeah.
Because they add just a little bit of context to what's going on and give like people more time to breathe and just live in this universe that it seems a bit weird to me that someone was cut, but I think we just kind of need to get into highlights and issues.
Yes.
Seeing as how we are talking about our issues with Tom Hardy right now.
As we move the spotlight to Amy right now, she is going to divulge the heinous of directors.
Dear Stuart Bard, not Scott Bard. I don't know if Scott Bard. Stuart Bard. I have a certain set of skills.
Oh my gosh.
I will find you. And if on the street at some time I do run into you, you might have a small act of violence coming your way. Whether it's perpetrated by myself or somebody else, I cannot tell you because that would make me liable and everyone listening culpable.
Okay. As well as premeditated.
And premeditated.
Yes, this is very premeditated.
So I'm just saying, sir, I have more than words that need to be.
So what is your issue with this man?
This is the actual issue.
Okay. So after getting that out of the way. Diana Troy is raped, mentally raped, literally on a very, first off, the shooting of the scene was super ridiculous. And to find out later that Commander Riker had to have his back hair CGI removed from the shot is great. But it's Riker and Troy's assuming honeymoon, wedding night, whatever, and they go to bed. And
as she's doing air quotes.
Yeah, there's air quotes that are needed. They go to bed and they pan up and it's a really, really poorly like Days of Our Lives type of shooting. Days of Our Lives would even play some music for you. And then, no joke, we get an interplay of Tom Hardy has suddenly taken Riker's spot on top of Deanna. And she's screaming and fighting him. And then it pans back to Ron Perlman with his hands on top of Tom Hardy's head and they are like literally psychically assaulting her and we're like, and I'm just like, what was the point of that? And then come to find out in those 20 minutes of deleted scenes, this fool, and when I say this fool, I mean Bard. The director is like, well, there were two rapes in there, you know, and I really wanted to keep the, you know, the one that was cut out. We really should have just kept it in. And he was so freaking gleeful about like, hey, do you know what? Rape. And I'm like, what was this rape doing to drive your point forward? Like, no, it wasn't necessary. It's never necessary and it's never should be a point of poorly written story that you need to rape one of the, I don't know, two verbally identified women on this crew to prove your point. Like, no, I don't know where you were living because even in 2000, it wasn't acceptable, dude. Like, this is the reason you don't direct anymore. Like, hard stop. And
brief aside, this is his last film credit
exactly.
for directing.
Exactly. Doesn't mean he's off the hook for this trash. Mm. And I think that was like, of everything that was cut out of this movie of 50, you said 50 minutes and we only saw 20.
Yeah.
Like of deleted scenes.
Well, I believe the director had said there was 50 additional minutes in the script. But I don't know if that translates to actual scenes filmed. So.
True. Well, either way, there was exposition. There was so much stuff that I saw in the deleted scenes that was cut that would have been great. That gave like, yeah, it could have set things up. It could have spoiled, quote unquote, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But you decided, hey, do you know what's really good? We should rape like a cat, like a fan favorite, just because I need to show how much of a menace and how petty Tom Hardy's character is because he doesn't get to touch her hair.
Yeah.
Like, give me a flipping break, bro. Like, when a girl says no, also, she looked dumbstruck when she's like, and they cut out the exposition when Troy is back with Picard and they're walking and Picard's like, tell me what you know about him. And she's like, well, he's arrogant and he's all these, like, she gives an exposition into how she reads him and how she sees him. But we don't get any of that. We literally get, they meet Shinzon, they go back to the Enterprise and everything's hunky-dory and peachy keen. Like,
yeah, like them cutting out that scene didn't make any sense to me. Also, I feel like, like, one, I completely forgot that even happened in this movie. So when I saw that scene happen again, I was like, oh no, like, yeah, not no. Deanna. Like that was very upsetting. And then I feel like the terrible cherry on the top of this nonsense situation is the director and his casualness of like, oh yeah, and like, he's just the fact that he was so into it.
Face.
Yeah, that was
and he like eagerly shifts in the chair about how, you know, this other one was just as good too, and I'm like, first off, no. Second off, no. Like, and then for somebody who, no joke, when Shinzon invades her mind, and we watched the deleted scene, which was much tamer, even though it was assault and it was a violation of her boundaries and her, like, her brain. He was not naked on top of her.
Yeah,
he was not in any way, shape, or form getting like physical with her as the one that was kept. The one that was deleted was literally he showed up in the elevator and was taunting her and being like, you want to know me. And he called her a nickname from...
Oh, the probably Imzadi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he called her a nickname and it was like super creepy. And if that had been the first thing, that would have set everybody on high alert. Mm-hmm. Like the second one where they decide to violate her and then she's off screen for like a good, you know, another 15 to 20 minutes.
Because you take the end of that scene that's actually in the film. And at the end of the event, you know, Tom Hardy, you know, Shinzon and the Viceroy are like, we have succeeded. The bonds have been broken. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like, there's what did that have to do with, like, I assumed at that point in time that Commander Riker was going to have a much bigger role in this film. And he's literally just hanging out at by the end of the film. You know, there's not a lot that's going on with his character pertaining to this overall story. So it's really weird how they needed, and I say needed as in the director stated, they needed to have this scene play out. For what purpose? I have no idea.
Yeah, no, I have no idea.
But even, I think, if they had gone the direction of just using that elevator scene as opposed to that one, I agree, that would have created much more of the creep. I mean, it still would have been overall creepy.
Yeah.
But to create that creepiness of like, it's slipping into the ranks of the Enterprise, and this means that he's not a good person. Like, you start getting that very strong premonition of like, okay, he does not have good intentions. That would have set the stage perfectly. Mm-hmm. But no, they had to go, like, as Amy stated so eloquently, they had to go all Days of Our Lives kind of format for this scene. And it turned into a really awkward, you know, young Tom Hardy with a much older Deanna Troi, Marina Sirtis. It seemed awkward. Like,
awkward is the polite way to put it. Yeah. It was literally in the I think it was the producer when we saw it. They talked about that they had cut an initial scene from Shinzon where he was introduced sitting in Parliament with the people that could have helped him commit the coup. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we didn't want that. We wanted something that would make him more mysterious. And so the one, like, and more of a menace. So when they put him in coming down the stairs in the dark, I was like, okay, that makes sense. That built the menace, that built the present.
Mm-hmm.
Literally jumping from that type of menace who's so controlled to suddenly he's just invading somebody's mind and raping somebody. First off, doesn't set up menace. Second, is not something that, like, of years of being an empath and being having, you know, telepathy, you think Deanna would, like, first off, I just, I don't understand.
Amy's using everything she knows from Jean Grey to figure out why she should have built a better defense around her brain.
I mean, to be fair, like, this type of thing has happened. Well, not the rape part, but like people trying to like get into Deanna's mind has happened before, and like some times it's just like, and then they need to communicate and they can't, and so they use her to do it, and so like, that was also a thing. I'm like, I feel like Deanna should like be a bit more on like the I need to protect myself when I can type thing. So I feel like
I said Jean Grey.
But then there's also like projecting, like he was projecting exactly at that moment to exactly where she was and to that exact position. Like I was like, this is for somebody who's just like, can I touch your hair? I've never seen a human woman. Can I touch your hair? To suddenly, hey, I'm going to mentally rape you. Like, no. No, sorry, mentally assault you. I don't know what our parameters are on using bad words, quote unquote.
Those words are just fine.
Thank you. Making sure. I'm just, no, this drags the story. Drags the story in such an unnecessary way where the story was already dragging and it pisses me off.
Yeah, and I think the final act of Deanna being the thing, being the person to... help the Enterprise attack Shenzhen because she's able to reach out and pinpoint where he is in space, which is also kind of just a crazy idea, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, that would just give her general direction. So I don't feel like that is really quite the comeuppance that, like, it just feels like a mismatch to me. Like, does anyone else agree or no?
No, I agree, because it doesn't seem like, unfortunately, because of the even though we stated she has ample screen time, she doesn't necessarily have as much as she should. Mm-hmm. And honestly, unless there was other scenes where it showed she was trying to like focus her mind or clear her mind and she kept getting, you know, images of the Viceroy in her head or stuff like that. Like if there was an ongoing connection that she was trying to clear out and couldn't by the time it got to that point in the film and then uses that connection against him and that's how that happens, that would have made sense. But none of what I said is in the movie except for the very last scene. And so it does create a kind of, you know, stunted belief kind of thing where you have to just take it at face value, like, oh, sure, you could, I guess you could do that. Yeah.
That's what we can do now.
Also, this reminded me of one thing I was kind of disappointed with. I was also disappointed with Picard's reaction to this, because she asked to be relieved to do it. He was like, no, I need you now more than ever, which is interesting because Picard has also been a person who has been violated with his mind being taken over by the Borg.
Yeah.
So I feel like he would also be like very empathetic to where she would be.
You mean it sounds like something the director would say if he was in his shoes?
Like, okay, so here's the thing about that is that this director about, while he is that, yes, he is also not someone well versed in Star Trek knowledge. So
no,
I'm not saying it's an excuse. I'm just saying that I feel like that's part of the problem with the story is that this person does not really know these characters.
Chooses not to know these characters.
Yes. Because like
blasphemous statement you say.
Because I was also reading an interview with Jonathan Frakes, Commander Riker, and he was mentioning how like he had directed some episodes of Star Trek and a movie at this point. So he was like, hey, you know, we're here. We work really well together and we would be happy to like help you out with anything that you need. And that offer was not like really taken up on.
Like you'd think for what? They had seven seasons. For seven seasons, you have people who have not only helped to foster these characters, but make sure that their backstory and themselves are fleshed out and believable. And if you wanted to be like, hey, you know what? This is how the story's been going. How do you guys feel about this in relation to your characters? You think someone would reach out and like trust the people that have been doing it for 7 years? Like, come on. Yeah. Come on. Just a little bit. Does anybody else have any other issues besides me?
Yeah. Ed, you have any highlights or issues?
I honestly... I think the only highlight I really can pull out of this is the wonderful arc that we get with Data. and Brett Spiner really creating that that ultimate appreciation of who Data is, and kind of coming to grips at this point in his story where we as fans who have been seeing him learn and grow and so forth come to a point to where, almost much like Spock, we have the point where he has become the most human he probably could be at this point. And the spoiler alert, you know, the way his story resolves at the end of this film, I have to give my hat off to Brent Spiner's work in that effort, and really kind of appreciate what they were trying to say, although they did it poorly, with the appreciation of not just time passing, but what time means to individuals, you know, and obviously, yes, Amy, that was something that was only said in the deleted scenes, but it is, it's like one of those things where it's like a puzzle where you have to see a certain way. Once you've been told how to see it, then you're like, oh yeah, you're right, I can see this. So, you know, after the fact, yes, I can appreciate that effort on their part, on Brent Spiner's part as well. I honestly cannot say anything that Amy hasn't already said pertaining to my issues, because it's a big issue.
Yeah.
And the fact remains is that to be so daft about it and so flippant about, oh yeah, well, you know, we were going to have two rape scenes. Yeah. Da, da, da. Like if he was saying, oh yeah, I'd like tomatoes with that too. Blah, blah, blah. Like it was almost like he was just ordering his lunch menu when he was talking about this. It was just so casual and like there's no harm in having this kind of imagery without purpose. Yes. And that's the big issue. When it comes to films, if there's no purpose behind the heinous atrocities that you put into film, then what is the point in even putting it there to begin with? Mm-hmm. You know, you look at films about war, you look at films about people who overcome, people who go through things like that. Yes, they are difficult to watch, and sometimes they're not everybody's cup of tea. But in the end, the purpose for this story to be told is to give you a glimpse of what victory looks like on the other side of things. And I got none of that from Deanna. So, yeah, my issues are the same. I have to, you know, seriously highlight Brent Spiner, who is just a phenomenal actor as well as singer. Hey, I liked him in the beginning of the movie, too. So, but yeah, that's about it for me. What about you, Spence?
I know. I think we've really covered most of the issues. So I think I want to just move on to the roundtable question.
Oh, boy. He's got one.
All right. So for this movie being the end of the Prime universe, the following movies take place in the Kelvin universe. This is our last movie in the main Star Trek timeline. How do you think this wraps up TNG's story?
Do you want to explain the flashback to the finale for the TNG? Do you remember?
Wait, what?
Well, because you're saying how this wraps up the TNG story versus like how
somebody did some reading did while you were talking.
Yes, I did, because I was like, I vaguely remembered how TNG ended.
Yes, all good things.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Where I'm like, my brain was like, wasn't it like trippy time, wibbly wobbly time?
Yes, it was very nice. It was a very good episode.
And so I was like, when with you prefacing and actually putting in the roundtable question beforehand, unlike somebody else who does our notes, yeah, I was able to go,
which isn't Amy because she doesn't do any of that. Go ahead.
I was going, well, I couldn't remember if I had entirely remembered the series finale correctly. Mm-hmm. And then with that in juxtaposition to this, I was like, I don't know if I answered your question. It sounds like I just went around in a circle.
I have no idea what you're saying.
I think I went around in a circle. Eddie, do you have an idea?
Honestly, I didn't see how this ends, so I don't really know. But if I were to give a somewhat educated guess, I would say that Data was somehow revived in his mind of this prototype and went on to command, and Picard went to go live in his vineyard. That's all I can think of, because they talked about wine a lot in this movie. That's all I'm saying. So I'm like, it's Picard Vineyard. Why not? And he just goes back to his vineyard.
Chateau Picard.
Okay, so I'm going to answer this question. So I think we have to take into account not where we are now, but when this was released. TNG, The Next Generation, had been going on from 1987 to this movie in 2002, so that's about 15 years. And from about 2002 to roughly, I want to say 2017, 2018, this was the end. There was nothing more. Like, it just stopped with Nemesis.
Okay.
So, like, there was nothing after this. Like, that was the end of their story until Star Trek Picard started. So, thinking of it from that point of view, this is kind of a terrible ending.
Yeah.
Because, like, it just kind of is a story in motion that stops, you know?
Yeah.
So there's nothing after this that really gives us fruition, like completion for this story.
Not till Star Trek Picard.
So then why did
so
we even
almost
use
20
it?
Years later?
Yeah. I'm sorry, what did you say?
So then why did we use it? Because for the series finale, it was like everything continues to go on. We've been saved one more time. You know, the universe is whole. And, you know.
So when was this series finale aired? Since Amy's going off of knowledge from the internet.
90?
I want to say 95 because I remember there was a handoff from TNG to Voyager.
Not 98. I was thinking 98.
No, that's much too late. Because
it'd been. Yeah, I see, and that's the thing where I'm like trying to think because that was more
94, sorry.
Oh, it was 94.
So it was 94. So okay. Yeah. So the series, the TV series portion of the story ended in 94.
Yeah.
And then the continual films that came out after the fact.
Yes.
And then ultimately because Nemesis was the last film of the 10 film saga.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing else after that.
Correct.
So we left off with this crew at the end of this film and then didn't follow back up with it until almost 20 years later with Picard.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And then Picard came in and kind of just cleaned up the mess of this movie.
Uh-huh.
And
good job, Picard.
Gave everyone like actual endings to their story. So, I think that's probably why this one is... one of the most hated in the fandom, because for the longest time it was just that was the end and there was nothing really good about that ending. Also, I feel like since this movie was in theaters, you have to make these movies just a touch more general access, not relying on such deep lore knowledge of like the TV series to be approachable to general audiences. And I think they overcorrected here because a lot of this feels kind of like a middling action movie, especially with like that dune buggy chase and some of the action sequences at the end of the movie with the big ships ramming into each other.
Yeah.
Which is a crazy thing to do.
Yeah.
Because especially since at the end of the, when Picard decides to ram the ship into another ship, he doesn't say to, evacuate the fore section of the ship.
No, he just rams it. He's like, brace for impact.
Yeah,
and like, just like, but he didn't even put on the comms. He just told the guys that were hanging out in the front. And I'm just like, what about everybody below that part?
Yeah, and they just lost the front part of that ship. So I was like, weirdness. So
weirdness is one way to put it.
Yeah. So like, I just feel like taking those into consideration, I feel like that's probably why it's so hated. But now that we actually do have an ending, it doesn't like absolve this movie of its problems, but like you get a kind of a different perspective of it, of like, since this isn't the end, it's just becomes like a not great chapter in a book.
Yeah.
You know, instead of a bad ending in a really good book.
But that's the thing that do you when the book has been really great and there's a really crappy chapter. Do you, I mean, like, this is one crappy chapter of how many crappy chapters in the prime universe?
Well, I mean, a lot of it's great, but some of it's bad, but like, I feel like there's more good than bad.
And the fact that this was the last time that we had the last chapter before any other chapters would be made long after, I can see how it can cultivate almost 20 years of hate based on just leaving it at that. So
yeah.
But yeah.
Okay, so wrapping it up, that brings us to our scoring of this. So, does this movie pass or fail? And how many monocles? Let's start with Amy.
Oh, man. gosh, okay. So, on the technicality of does this movie have a beginning, middle, and an end, it does pass in that regard. Do I like it? No. To be brutally honest, as much as I have enjoyed so many other wonderful things from Star Trek, even the campiness of some of it, and some of the really poor choices for uniforms, listen to last year's episodes to hear about my opinions on Star Trek clothing and uniforms. This felt like they did not know what they were doing with an all-star team, and essentially sunk them in the end. And there was a lot of metallic pleather in this thing that was not used in the right spaces.
Metallic pleather?
Yeah.
Like Shinzon's outfit?
Yes.
That was some
stiff, like some Scotch guard on them shoulders. So unfortunately, despite my deep and abiding love for Sir Patrick Stewart and the cast of Star Trek TNG, I'm going to have to give this like a 2 out of 5 monocles because like I would give it less, but I like the cast of TNG.
Eddie.
In terms of whether or not it passes or fails, this one obviously will fail for me in terms of how the storyline comes together, brings it to full completion. I didn't like how this film wrapped up and how it kind of took the easy way of, you know, easy shortcut ways of trying to complete the story. I appreciate Tom Hardy's efforts. I think they should have gotten a different actor. All in all, this film isn't the best. It isn't the best film out of the entire franchise. I would say it isn't the worst, because I do have to say I did get a chance to watch some of the first film.
You went back after last year and watched part of the first.
The motion picture.
That movie is like drag.
Did you watch the regular edition or director's cut?
I don't know. I got to look at what I got on Vudu.
Okay, I can tell you. Did your movie start with 3 minutes of space?
Yes.
Then that's the director's cut.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So just music and space.
That takes a effort of patience that I just didn't have. so it's not the worst, but it also isn't good as a whole as well. In terms of monocles, I am also going to give this movie a 2. One monocle for Jean-Luc Picard and one monocle for Brent Spiner, because they are absolutely wonderful and they are the powerhouses of this film and their characters, Patrick Stewart and Brent Spiner. And I appreciate them. So I really did enjoy their arcs in the film. So 2 monocles for me. Spencer, what about you?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you both. This, well, like you, Eddie, this movie fails for me.
I just passed it because I thought it had need a beginning, middle, and an end. If that's the case, it's not going to pass for me. Like, if I could reject that, I still get it a 2, but I'm not going to see this again. Sorry.
You did say that it failed already.
No, I said it.
She passed it.
I passed it. I thought you failed it. I thought it was the requirement that it had to have a beginning, middle, and an end.
No, it's so
it is up to you.
We're going to have to do an episode on how we score properly.
Yes, please. So if the
film
case is failing.
Grading score.
Yes, please. So failing, I'm okay with it failing. Spencer. But it's getting a 2.
Okay, so yeah, fail. Here's the thing. And I forgot to mention this is my issues. One of the things I dislike is that Worf, while being in this movie, does nothing.
He does. I mean, he shoots a couple people, but that's it.
Yeah, but like
and he jumps on his tummy.
Yeah, but like he barely is. It, like I did like that tummy jump. And same problem with Beverly too. Like she's there for like a couple medical scenes, but like gone. You know. So I just feel like this movie just does not utilize all of the cast as it could. Some of these stronger entries like do utilize people. So for me, it's a 2. Like, yeah, I don't think this is the worst one, but like it's a bad one that set everything back like 7 years for our next movie that we'll be talking about next week.
Woo.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, that about wraps up one of our first episodes for Star Trek Month of this year, and another great episode for you listening. We thank you for checking us out, and we hope you come back for more. If you want to check out all of our stuff, you can head on over to our website at filmlosophers.com. There we have allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, sci-fi. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Film Losophers. Give us a follow or a subscribe. Listen in. Tell us how we're doing. How did you feel about Star Trek Nemesis? Is it one of your favorites? If it is, we need to send you to the nearest hospital.
Please know why.
After you tell us why. And let us know your thoughts. And we'd love to hear those thoughts in the comments down below. Also, if you feel so froggy, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
After this movie, yeah.
Also, you can check us out over on the socials where we're at Facebook, facebook.com/filmlosophers, and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. We're also on Blue Sky. We're on Threads. And we're on
Twitter.
I said Instagram and Twitter. Twitter and Instagram at Filmlosophy101. We're on Threads at Filmlosophy101 as well, and Blue Sky at The Film Losophers Podcast. So if you're on Blue Sky, follow us there.
Yay.
Also, you can catch all of our great hijinks on our social pages, as well as our extra segment content, such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane Unseen, which can be found where?
The only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane Unseen on Instagram and Instagram only. I mean it.
You're doing a whole Miss Minutes thing over there from, you know.
I could. I could turn on that voice if we needed it, but I don't think it was required for my internship.
No. But yeah, you can check us out there. We hope you tune in this entire month as we have a great amount of content coming your way pertaining to Star Trek, pertaining to giveaways, because we do have a giveaway to announce next week.
We have a giveaway.
We mentioned it at our trivia night the other night at There and Back Cafe and Game. So stay tuned to our social pages for more. From all of us here at the Film Philosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Still intern Amy.
Class dismissed.